everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Just Get Started podcast. I'm your host, Brian Andreco, and thanks again for being a part of this journey. On today's episode, I welcome in Carl Hughes, who is the CEO of Draft.dev and thepodcastconsultant.com. After a decade leading software engineering teams at venture-funded startups, Carl started down the path of entrepreneurship. He founded Draft.dev in 2020, and within 2 years, the company reached $2.5 million in annual revenue. After removing himself from the day-to-day, Carl partnered with longtime friend Manuel Weiss to purchase another digital service business, The Podcast Consultant. They are currently focused on implementing an organic growth strategy and streamlining operations at the 24-person podcast production business. In his free time, Carl likes to write about his journey buying and scaling digital service businesses, running races, and spending time with his family in downtown Chicago. So I hope you all enjoy this conversation with Carl. And without further ado, please welcome in Carl Hughes. Carl, welcome to the podcast. Good to have you today.
Hey, Brian. Good to see you.
Yeah, good to see you too. I'm glad. You know, I know we serendipitously connected, and it's always fun that way of like how you meet folks, and especially doing this podcast over, you know, in year seven, it's kind of interesting all the different ways I run into people. So, good to chat with you. Good to know you.
It's a small world, and it's, you know, there's times when you just got to lean into those random connections, right? Yeah.
Well, you find too, and there's a spot I really want to start with you, but actually I'm kind of curious now that we're just, you know, noodling on this to begin. It is interesting, and I'm sure you've seen this in your career, like you don't realize what's out ahead, the path, and like the amount of people you meet, connection, just random conversations, how that not just is like someone makes a door open for you, but how it maybe opens a new idea in your mind. Isn't that really interesting? Like, Have you found that a lot through your career?
Absolutely. I took a really windy career path to where I'm at. Studied mechanical engineering, started my own little company in college, and it never went anywhere. Went to work for a little startup, bounced around, became a software engineer and a software engineering manager, and then hired people, was a CTO, like, and then started my own content writing business. So like, yeah. I've been making left turns all over. And it's funny, like but to say all that is the experience, the network, and the different backgrounds of people I met along the way gave me a ton of insight that made me have a really unique skill set to actually take the leap in entrepreneurship and like drive a ton of value quickly, because I had these really weird mix of skills from before.
You mentioned college. I'm kind of intrigued with that. You said you kind of started something there and then didn't go forward with it, and obviously went into corporate America, right? Working for a startup, working for businesses. Did you always want to do your own thing? Like, was that, I guess, you know, probably a lot of younger folks listening into this might be like, well, I have an idea. Like, once you feel like you're there, oh my God, if I go to corporate America, I'm selling out. Like, did you have that feeling at all? Or?
So a little bit. I mean, I remember going to college and picking mechanical engineering because I thought it was like a safe, steady major that was always going to have a job, right? And that's probably true. But like, I got into my first internship after my freshman year, and everybody there, really big, well-known, reputable company, everybody there just works for the weekend. Like, they didn't really care about anything they were doing. None of the, like, everything was so slow and bogged down in bureaucracy that for somebody like me who, like, I really like to move fast and try things, it was just not the environment. And I realized that. I did another internship with a big company, and again, double realized that. And I was just like, I got to get out of this and do something a little more creative and interesting. I took around the same time, took a class on engineering entrepreneurship, and it just blew me away. Like, it was completely night and day different way of thinking. And that sort of set me on the course of, hey, I'm never going to go work for a massive company again. You know, when you say I went to corporate America, I went to work for 5 to 10 person companies. So very different from, my internships. And then, but it got me into thinking like long-term entrepreneurship is definitely what I want to do. I wasn't quite ready full-time right out of college, but definitely that was like on my trajectory.
So you didn't go into college wanting to be like an engineer?
I mean, I knew it. So this is funny. I picked the major mechanical engineering because my high school physics teacher told me, Carl, there's no way you're going to be an engineer. And so out of spite and the fact that I did like physics, I was like, all right, you know, I'm going to go make this happen. So I started this career in mechanical engineering. And again, I just kind of got through a couple years of it and was like, it's just too much. This big company stuff is not going to be exciting. And then I started teaching myself software engineering on the side, and that's kind of where my career actually went after that.
What's the, you don't have to give a, you don't have to give me an education on this, but I'm a, from a novice, I kind of understand mechanical engineering, I think, but like, what are the similarities between that and software engineering, and what are the vast differences, I guess, just for, to level set?
Yeah. I mean, in practice, there's a lot of differences as far as like the technologies you'll work with. So typically in mechanical engineering, what you're going to be doing is building software models or building out designs for mechanical systems. That means gears. It means fluid movement. So it could be pipes. It could be going to power plants and testing things. It could be building cars. So pretty wide range. I actually worked at a place that GE Appliances that did like washing machine. Made washing machines, designed them. And then also Siemens Healthcare, which does CT and PET scans and things like that. So yeah, there's a ton of mechanical pieces in all those. Now, software engineering is totally different, but in mechanical engineering in school, you're going to take some basic programming courses. So that kind of got me far enough into like seeing what programming was to at least give myself some framework there. And then software engineering is a pretty broad field these days too, but I kind of got my start hacking around on PHP and HTML and some of the really basic stuff. And I'm a curious person. I love to learn. I love to learn that first 80% of things. That last 20%, I get bored. And so I kind of let other people do that. But that first 80% is really freaking fun to me when you're going from like complete unknown to like, I actually kind of know what I'm doing. And that's what software was for me for the first 5-6 years, is like going from 0 to 80% knowledge in the space was like, amazing. And then I got to that point, I was like, man, I don't want to write code all day. I got to find something else to do. And I kind of pushed into management from there.
When you went, so you said that you went to your first startup was like 5 to 10 people you went to. What was that? The reason was because of the corporate, you didn't want to be a part of the
team. I just knew I didn't want to go to a place where everybody just kind of phoned it in every day. Like I wanted to be around people who were excited to work on something. And even though the startup was, I mean, it was like a Craigslist for college students. So it was kind of a cool idea. It wasn't like, you know, I don't know, changing the world in some massively altruistic way, but it's still like just more fun to be out there on the edges, creating like kind of the future possibly, even if it doesn't work out, it's still like you kind of got a foot out there and you get to try it.
Well, and yeah, I love that. I remember working for, I was like employee 24 at a startup, and it was just so much fun because you can kind of, because I'm, again, similar to you, is a very curious and very just like want to be able to put my foot, my fingerprint on it, you know, on something. So I think it gives you more. When you go to a big company, you're kind of, there's only so much you can do, right? There's too many levels.
Yeah.
So here's the, where I wanted to get to. I know we kind of went around there. I appreciate some of the backlog there to help us. So 2020, you make this decision to start this company. My curiosity, though, is can you take us back maybe whether it was a month, 6 months, a year, 2 years, whatever it was, how long did you actually think about starting before you took the leap? Or what did you do in between? Did you kind of side hustle it?
I wrote a blog post about this soon after I started Draft.dev, which was my first company that took off, about the 10 little side projects or, you know, things I tried to start between college and when I actually started something that worked.
Yeah.
And so there was a ton of little side hustles. And each one of those, I have kind of a like summary of what it was and what I learned along the way. Right. And like most of them didn't get further than like concept and then like maybe first MVP built or something like that. Cause I was an engineer, so I could tinker with this stuff. Some of them, I tried to make some sales. Some of them I made a tiny bit of money, but I learned, doing that several times on the side while having a day job, A, it gave me security. Like I didn't have to have those things work, but B, it allowed me to pick up a bunch of those tangential skills, which are really critical in entrepreneurship. You know, the building the software app, a lot of times people in my field, like in software engineering, we over-index on how valuable that really is. A lot of software engineers think that their quality of their software or the quality of their product is going to be what differentiates them. But what I found in, you know, doing this several times is that like really what matters is access to market. Like there's so many software tools out there that are really not very good, but still have massive market penetration. And it's not because the software was great. It's because they had some kind of in or leverage within a certain market that got them the access they needed to make the sales to then grow. So I think learning that through all these side projects was super helpful because that completely framed and changed the way I looked at starting draft.dev. I went into it from a day zero. I will write no code and I will minimize the amount of time I'm doing production work for clients. And kind of took that ethos because I knew that's the way you grow a company, not by being the founder who goes in hands-on, builds everything. Mm.
Well, so when you talk about the market then, how much did you know about that market going into it, or like knowing like, hey, this is the right fit, or did it just spawn over time? You had to pivot a little bit and found it.
Yeah, it's a little of both. So what had happened was just before the pandemic, a year or two up to the pandemic, I had run a newsletter called CFP Land, which was for tech people who want to speak at tech conferences. And a lot of those people are in this field called developer relations. I never would have known this was a thing unless I had started this newsletter and started speaking at conferences, right? This is all just kind of like accidental. None of this was like, and think about building an agency for them until much later. But basically, I heard from all these people in developer relations, you know, hey, content's really like, we're always trying to produce more content. And then the pandemic hit, they couldn't go to events, but they still had budgets that they had to use on something, right? And so content really picked up after that. So what happened simultaneously was the startup I was working for hit a kind of bad spot in their fundraising cycle, just as COVID is taking off. And so the whole thing was starting to kind of fall apart, and they took the engineers down to halftime to save some money, and they were going to go try to sell the company. So I was like, well, you know, life gives you lemons, right? Let's make some lemonade. Let's just go with this self-employment thing and figure it out. So I started writing on the side. That turned quickly into me hiring other writers. That turned quickly into me hiring writers and editors. Within 6 months, I was kind of like hiring a small team and full-time on draft.dev. And I was mostly in a sales role at that point.
Mm, wow. Okay. So it took off pretty quick then. I mean,
very fast. Year zero was 50K in revenue. That was when I was kind of doing it part-time. Year one was 1 million in revenue, and then it was 2.5 million in revenue. So it took off extremely fast, especially for a service business. Mm.
So how do you think, and well, there's a lot of different areas I want to go with you here. Let's stick on this for a second, and then we can kind of navigate around. But like, how, because you're not doing that, like you're not full in the operations every day. How do you make that decision to go do something else? You know, like change course? Because if it's working, it's like, hey, why not just stick with this? Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, why do something else if it's working for yourself specifically? Or maybe it's that 80%. Maybe it's that 80% thing of like, you got to 80% and you're like, I gotta do something else.
Yeah, you nailed it, Brian. So here's the thing. Like, I got to a point 2 years into draft.dev. I took a whole month off when my second kid was born. I did no emails, no calls, nothing, right? The team could run fairly well without me. Now, they weren't making big strategic changes or anything, but like, they were day to day extremely capable in doing it. And that's where the team is today. So getting the business to that point, I really hit this like existential crisis. Like, what am I doing? Why? What is my purpose here anymore? You know, if like all they need me for is a couple hours of kind of high level strategy every month, why am I, you know, why, what am I doing? So I started working with a coach, business and personal coach kind of, that, you know, he started to get me thinking about the idea of do something, like you got to find something bigger, something that's going to take you 10 years, something that's going to be like exciting. And I arbitrarily, he forced me to, you know, pick some things to chase, right? Like, he's like, okay, so what do you want to do? Like, you've got to start to come up with things and make up numbers around them. So I picked this big goal. I said, I want to, over the next 10 years, I want to buy or own at least 10 companies doing $100 million in total revenue. So at that point I had one company doing $2.5 million in revenue. So I got a long way to go, but I figured that's a huge, I'm going to have to learn a ton of things to get to that point, right? Mm-hmm. Like the person I will be in 10 years, even if I get to half of that goal, will be a totally different person than I am today. My day to day, the way I think about like prioritizing things, the understanding I have of business, mm-hmm. the skills I have. And so putting myself on a 10-year journey that requires a ton of different leveling up of those skills was way more exciting to me than just saying, how can I make this business 20% better next year, 20% better next year, 20% better next year. Mm. So that was kind of what got me. It was like, I got to find something that's really hard and it's going to take a long time. And then I'm going to have to learn a ton of skills up to 80% or more. And I think this is the path I'm on now.
I want to go back to the coach a bit, because I think it's so important to have a team around you. Like, why did you decide to use a coach, or had you used a coach before? Is this the first time?
Yeah, that was the first time. I have not used a coach. So I've always strongly believed in the power of mentors, peers, and mentees, people that you can like kind of that look up to you too. So I think all those relationships are really important. I had a lot of those. I had a list of mentors from day one who were people who had done significantly bigger things. I had a lot of peers I met with regularly. But what I never tried was having a coach. I picked this guy up because I joined the EO, which is Entrepreneurs Organization. Mm-hmm. They have an accelerator program. EO is a big global entrepreneur network, and there's some kind of like requirements to get in. But if you're a little under those requirements, you can do their accelerator. Anyway, I met this guy who's a business coach in the accelerator program. Really quality guy. I just jived with him. It's kind of like he fit my style. And I was like, okay, let's, you know, work together. And so started working together. And I think what I realized is that the coaching for me, it's not so much tactical, like here's how to solve your next problem and go to the next thing, because that stuff, there's no right answers, but B, there's a million people who tell you a million different things. Mm-hmm. It's a lot more about managing my own psychology and getting over the barriers that I put for myself up. And I think that is what a really good coaching tends to be, is like helping people break through those barriers that they've put for themselves, whether those barriers relate to your skills, saying I'm not good enough to do that, I'm not as smart as that guy, I'm not as well-spoken as them, or they're related to your mindset of like, there's no way, I'm not the kind of person who can run a $100 million holding company. Like all that is bullshit. Like there's no, that's none of that's true. It's just you've made in your mind that this mm-hmm. determination is the way you think about yourself. And that's what puts these barriers up. So anyway, that's what coaching has helped me with, is breaking through those barriers and believing that I can be whoever I want. It's just about putting in the work and doing the next step.
Was there any question that you remember the coach asking, maybe to spark some sort of aha moment? Anything specific you'd share around that?
It was a process of asking me really good questions about how I thought about myself and my own capacity. I think so. Anytime you start to get into like bettering yourself, you'll start to ask the question like, has anyone done this thing you're trying to do or something remotely like it? Mm-hmm. And what enabled them to do it that you don't have? Is there any legitimate like reason that they had like some unfair advantage that you don't have right now? And if they did, how do you get that unfair advantage? How do you go to where they were, right? This is, Tony Robbins talks about this, the idea of modeling. It was essentially like you go find the 10 people who are doing something similar to what you want to do and figure out what they did. Like just follow those steps. Mm-hmm. And when you break it down, it sounds really simple, but to be truthful, it is. It's just a matter of doing it every day and consistently over many, many years and probably decades that is the difference maker. And of course, there's some luck along the way. But at the end of the day, like, you know, again, if I hit the 100 million, if I hit 50 million, or if I hit 10 million, it's still better than I am today. And that's the real goal, is like building progress. So I don't think it was one thing. It was more just an exposure over time. And we met weekly and we still meet weekly. So you get a lot of exposure to somebody and they kind of force you to rethink a lot of things. Yeah. So it's just that process over and over again.
Well, you're right. And I think the biggest hurdle for most folks is that first step of like, you know, there's back when I had a lot of imposter syndrome and didn't feel, you know, like I was worthy. I came up with this question. I actually have it on my mirror in my bathroom. It says, why can't it be you? And I ask that to myself over and over again. And maybe that's encouragement others listening in. Like just that simple, because if you can get over the hump of knowing that, wait a minute, I can do this. Not everyone, no one else is more special than I am. Like we're just humans. We're just trying to do our best. Then you can take the next leap, like you mentioned, and just go for it and figure out modeling. How do you actually, you know, get it to work? But you have to actually have confidence that you can do it first to even take that first step. And I think that's where a lot of folks struggle. And maybe, I don't know if you see this with young business owners as well, like almost hesitant to even make decisions.
Absolutely. Oh, and this is the thing that's, I actually, that you bring up decisions a really good pivot point here, because that was one of the hardest things that I found in the first year of entrepreneurship, was going from there's always a CEO to kick big decisions up to it's you. Like, Carl, you're the end of the line. Yeah. You have to make every big decision if it's going to be made. And that was really like hard at first. And that's why I almost, you know, I got trapped in this whole, like, what am I doing here? Kind of thought, where I take a whole month off and I'm not needed. And it's like, well, I have a big decision to make, is what I realized. And what I realized too, that this is something else that's kind of formed over time though. And this hopefully takes the pressure off for people who get to this point and they're nervous about it, is it honestly doesn't matter what decision you make, so long as you make one and you're deliberate in your actions to follow through on it. Mm. So whether that decision is, I want to go full time and be a full time entrepreneur, and I want to make, you know, $1 million with my own business, or that decision is something much smaller, and, you know, make whatever you feel comfortable with, but just make it and go for it. There's nothing wrong with saying in 2 years, oh, that wasn't the right decision, I'll go back and do something else. That's something else I've been really trying to be open to, is that whole mentality around be very deliberate, have a very big long-term vision, but be very flexible in how you get there and willing to change if opportunity strikes in a certain way.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think that's right. Is if you're keep muddling back and forth, that's worse off, because a no decision is a decision as well, right? And it's
absolutely,
and you just keep sputtering.
And I think a lot of small business owners of any experience level face this, where they do themselves a huge disservice by not just picking a goal and going for it. Again, you never know if it's the right goal. There is no such thing as the right and wrong goal. It's really just about having a big waypoint that is far enough in front of you that you feel like you're making progress and you have something to shoot for. That's motivating, it's exciting, it's progress. That's the like mental sort of lift you need to keep pushing things forward. And again, you're going to find it might have been the wrong one occasionally, but like at least you were making progress. You'll learn a ton along the way.
How do you think about on that point about like goal setting and like putting those, because you know, from a development side, I'm assuming like a lot of times you're thinking in sprints, like these short bursts and moving forward. Sure. But is that how you think about business as well? Or do you set it up a different way?
Yeah. So I break it down. I've got the 10-year goal. I've got a little model that will get me to that 10-year goal. And then every year I kind of have set waypoints. So this year I want to buy at least one more company and get a general manager running one of the companies. Next year, I want to buy a couple companies and raise a small fund to do more acquisitions. Like, will I hit those? Who knows, right? Like at the end of the day, like all the specifics could move, but you have to have like a very, like if you're going to pursue something really big over 10 years, you kind of have to break it down into yearly and then quarterly things that are going to happen in order to get there. And you don't always hit them, but like you've got to make progress towards them or else you'll just never get anywhere.
You're right. Well, and you even mentioned too, like getting from zero to what the draft.dev was doing. Now that creates that momentum to accelerate a lot quicker. You know, it's not
right.
You have to do it's a longer haul to start, but then the momentum picks up and the dominoes.
Oh, absolutely. Start falling, right? And same with coming up with ideas. I think a lot of people get obsessed with like, I got to find the perfect idea before I get started. I argue the opposite is true. Get started, find a way to become self-sufficient as an entrepreneur, and the ideas come as free as candy after that. I mean, you can't tell you how many good business ideas that run across from existing customers, from partners, from just people in the industry that I run into. I never would have had these ideas or thought about them at all if I hadn't had some exposure to owning my own business, having these higher level conversations, thinking strategically and financially about opportunities. Now, I can't pursue them all. This is like the hard part is like, right. I want to do them all, or I want to have a team that does them all, and I can't. So the next thing is like learning discipline, right? But like, it's funny, like I used to think that same way, like if my idea wasn't perfect, the business model wasn't perfect on day zero, that I shouldn't do it. And I would let that stop me. A lot of my side project ideas were, there's not enough market. I don't really think this is a good enough project. I can't build this one. And that was all just bullshit excuses. Like the truth is, if I had found a way earlier, like the real ideas started to flow fast and furious once I actually was out there full-time self-employed and had the leverage and the height above things to just see all the opportunities out there.
Yeah. I couldn't agree with you more. I think that the ideas if you don't put any ideas down, if you don't write, let's say, then it might be day seven that you really hit a good idea, but you will never get there until you actually give yourself that time. So yeah, right. Continual kind of in the lab, if you will, you know, working. Yeah. Let's talk about acquiring businesses, right? Well, one, I guess I'm curious, like, is there a spot where you could see businesses that are for sale, or are you proactively saying like, oh, this would be a cool business or market, and then going after? How are you thinking about that?
Yeah, so the second business that I have now, I bought last year with a partner. The way we went about that was what is called in the acquisitions world, like a proprietary search, which basically means we've reached out to small businesses we thought would be a good fit and tried to get on a call and learn if they really were a good fit and then qualify them. I got exposed to this whole world of acquisitions through, so I do some guest lecturing at Kellogg, which is the MBA program here in Chicago for Northwestern. And I got to meet some people who do these things called search funds. And this is a getting to be a more popular idea in the MBA world, where a search fund is put together by a person who just graduated with their MBA. Typically, they're going to go out and they're going to try to raise a little bit of money and take a big loan out and buy a $10 million business. So they usually try to buy pretty big because they're looking to be a real CEO, right? Yeah. But it got me exposed to this whole world of buying small businesses, which they do. They go out and they have all these words they use, like proprietary search, and they have brokered search, and they have all these other things that they exposed me to and I learned about. So I learned about their whole process. I learned how they typically finance these deals. I learned how they typically will get the revenue for them, the financing for them from banks or from the SBA or from private investors. So I knew all those things were possible. And so when I started to think about how do I build a 10 company empire in 10 years, like acquisitions is going to have to be it. So first step is find something to buy. So I learned how to do that. So we bought a relatively small company. It's not as big as draft.dev even, but it taught us so much about going through the process of like buying a company and like what it's like to go through the bank and what it's like to talk about all the, like look through the financials of somebody else's company and what it's like to run somebody else's company. So it's been really great from a learning side, even if the numbers aren't huge yet. Plus I do think there's a lot of room for growth in it. It's just, you know, going to take time and effort. So that was that process and where that kind of evolved from.
So how do you think, like, do you have a checklist? You don't have to share all the, you know,
yeah.
But like in terms of certain markets you're going after or businesses, like how are you thinking about that? And obviously 10 years, a long time, that might change in 2 years, but currently today, right. How do you think about it?
Yeah, I think, yeah, you're hitting on the right question. So the first question was, what complements the existing business that does content writing? So content writing aimed at software engineers, that's what draft.dev does. We were like, we want it to be something niche that focuses on a pretty specific market. And we want it to be something that operates well financially. So it's got good numbers behind the scenes. So good revenue, good margin, consistent growth, pretty like reliable client base. We wanted to see like no concentration in clients. So meaning when you're going to buy an agency, if it has two clients or 90% of its revenue is one client, it's a pretty risky buy versus if you buy an agency that has 80 clients and none of them are more than 5 or 10% of the revenue, pretty safe buy, relatively speaking. So lots of things like that we were looking at. There is a whole checklist. I put a lot of these things out on my personal blog when we bought the company. But so that was kind of what we were looking for. We also decided we wanted to get into the podcasting space for a couple of reasons. I mean, obviously I like podcasts. I'm here, right? Yeah. Like this is partly because I believe in this medium, but a few things. One is I think in 10 years, we'll have more businesses using podcasting, whether it's video or audio or both, as a marketing channel than you have today, especially these kind of high trust businesses, coaching, financial advising, consulting, anything like that. Very good opportunity here in podcasting because it's such a personal medium, both with the listener and with the guest. It's a great chance to build relationships. So I knew that podcasting was powerful, and I knew right now businesses are always, you know, 20 years behind the curve on like picking up all the latest stuff in marketing, right? So wanted to get into this space, but then also draft.dev, my other company, could use the video and audio editing production services to help their clients. So I knew there was kind of going to be some cross-sell opportunities or some white labeling opportunities. And then finally, the last opportunity I see with buying niche agencies like this is being able to share the back office services. So one of the other challenges with a small agency, say under $5, $10 million, is you can't hire full-time accountants and HR people and a lot of those like behind the scenes operational roles. Because it's just not cost, like doesn't make sense. You end up hiring these fractional people who there's some overhead built into. So we want to build a shared services model on the back end too. Now that's all kind of like the big vision. Like you said, in 2 years, we might realize that we want to buy a software company and sort of shift this a bit because of something. But right now what we're aiming towards is building up a portfolio of these niche, very specific productized services.
And when you say productized services, what do you mean by that?
What I mean by that is that they can kind of be sold a little more like a product is than like a traditional agency service. So a lot of times with traditional agencies, you're going to say, here's a retainer. We're going to bill you for every hour we work. These are a little more billed on a completion of a project or a part of a project work. So with the podcast production company we bought, we charge you per episode based on some features you decide yes or no on. Draft.dev, it's per article, per blog post that we write. And so that kind of broken down billing, it gives, there's some opportunities as far as like maximizing your margins by just knowing what the like average cost of it to produce is, and then kind of like giving a simple pricing out to clients. But then also for clients, it's just easier for them to grok it. They don't have to worry, what if Carl spends 20 hours in this blog post and we only want him to spend five? It's like, it's a fixed price. That's my problem to solve. So there's advantages to it like that. Now, there's a degree of productizing, because some of our clients probably wouldn't even think of us as productized because they just sort of see an overarching package that they buy, but it doesn't really matter. Behind the scenes, we want to be able to sort of make the work so sort of well specified that we don't get into this like this kind of like hourly work trading, you know, brain for dollars.
Okay, I get that. So based on that, I'm kind of curious your thoughts around, so someone starting a business, or let's say they're early on, what are some things either you've learned from running your own or maybe going through this acquisition and seeing other businesses? Like, what are some of the best businesses doing? That could be from a leadership standpoint. That could be how they're structured and pricing. You take it wherever you want to take it, whatever you think is best.
Well, I'll tell you, with smaller companies, let's talk about smaller companies, and let's talk about agencies specifically, because that's maybe my realm where I have the most expertise. And I've talked to hundreds of agency owners over the last couple of years as I look through doing this acquisition. I'm looking at doing another one this year. The best ones have figured out how to remove themselves from the production or sort of like delivery of their service. And then those are the good ones, let's say. The even better ones have figured out how to also remove themselves. The founders have removed themselves from sales and customer interactions. And then at that point, you're able to look a higher level and just see the business as a sort of machine that you can kind of move the levers or put resources around in the right places to push what you need. Whether that's growth, you need to like invest in adding, getting capacity in a new industry, acquisitions, or it's just refining processes or getting better people in to refine those processes. It's so, you can't do that when you're stuck in delivery of the service, or you're stuck in must do more sales, must do more, like, you know, grinding on the treadmill of like getting leads in, getting calls booked, securing accounts. It's not that any of that stuff's not important. It's absolutely critical. But like, once you have the visibility to get above it, it gets so much easier to run, and you get so much more clear on how to build it to the next level.
Basically taking the bottleneck is you removing that bottleneck from the process, what you're saying.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's pretty common wisdom. Like the E-Myth is a really good book on this topic, if you're kind of unfamiliar with the idea, but essentially it's building standard operating procedures and then putting people in place to own those standard operating procedures and improve them over time. So what I did tactically early on at draft.dev, from day one, I started tracking my time. I'd track how much time I spend writing, how much time editing, how much time marketing, how much time doing sales, even though I was one employee, right? I'm one person doing everything, but what I wanted to do was build out a model that I knew I could always spend. I want to always spend 50% of my time on sales and growth, and 50% of my time on client delivery at first. And then once one gets sort of like, you know, once I see I'm spending 8 hours a week on writing, I need to outsource that. I need to get somebody else to write. And of course, the first few articles that I hired somebody to write for were terrible, and I had to completely redo them myself. But like, that's the sort of like journey every entrepreneur goes through. But I knew, like, discipline wise, I was like, I'm not going to let myself fall into the trap of doing all client work or sort of like doing all sales. And then once, you know, again, I got myself to a point where I could get out of the client work, I started to look at getting out of the sales and hired a salesperson. That took a year and a half or so. But you know, every company hits it at different times. It just depends how tight your product market fit is and how well it's going.
Is it a mixture of, I guess, cost, meaning if someone's like, oh, I have to hire someone, well, that taken out of my pocket, but also ego? Like, what's the balance of ego versus cost there of like, why someone doesn't remove?
Well, it's definitely both. You bring up a really good point. So in the short term, your margins will absolutely take a hit once you hire salespeople or a salesperson, because A, they won't close as many deals as you. You have to be okay with that. And then B, they're essentially coming out of your net profit, right? So if, you know, typical service business, you're not going to close thousands of deals. You close a couple deals a month, you know, 2 to 10 a month or something like that, right? So if they have to get a commission, if they get a commission on every one of those deals, that's money that comes right out of your, as the owner's, net profit in the short term. Now, in the long term, that person should sort of turn a corner where they can do more sales activities or free you up to do bigger, higher leverage activities like acquisitions, like partnerships, like really big sales to really multifaceted companies, you know, things like that, that you wouldn't have been able to do if you had to take every single, you know, booked call. So you've got to figure out a way to do that. Now, I think easy way to start with that is like maybe you have a salesperson who just does your follow-up emails, just does keeping in touch with prospects. Mm-hmm. Maybe you have a salesperson who just answers the first call and then they pass them on to you if they're a good lead. They do qualifying, right? And you know a lot more about sales, Brian. So like I'd like say that mine is very like, I've only learned this the last couple of years, so I have a long way to go on learning sales, but I think you know how this goes. Like there's different roles in sales. And so pretend like you are doing those different roles and then track your time, see how much time you're spending on that low level SDR stuff and try to get somebody else to do it once you can. Yeah. So that's what I've done at least. And it so far has worked really well for getting me out of the business. And of course I have to lose some net margins in it, but that's short-term loss for a long-term gain.
Yeah. Well, and I will add on, because you make a great point about the documenting the steps and the time and all that. Because from a sales standpoint, I see this a lot with founders I talk with, is they may have sold, quote unquote, like they made some calls, they happen to bring in some business. And now they're like, oh, I don't want to sell because most don't like to do it. Let me bring in someone.
Right.
But they have no idea how to hire the right salesperson because they don't know, like, what are the steps in the sales process? Like, what are some of the things we need to be looking for? What's the type of sales role I need here? Like, so I think it is really important is like not only to sell and go through that whole process, but actually document it so you know what you're hiring for. Because a lot of folks miss that.
That's a really good point. Actually, that brings up like, basically what I did. I talked to some salespeople I knew who were really good when I was thinking about hiring somebody, and they were all like, you need to get them a script. You need to get them some expectations about what they realistically can do in a day or a week, and you need to have CRM, you need to have like a deck, and you need to have follow-up emails and all that templated out for them. So I spent probably 4 or 6 weeks just like putting all that together, because again, I'm not a salesperson. I did all this, the first $1 million in sales was off the cuff. It was just Carl and his brain, mm-hmm. you know, on a call with people. And I could do that because I knew the business so well, I knew my market so well, I just kind of like intuitively knew how to talk to these people. But I'd never thought about making it into a deck, making it into like a process. And then once again, people told me that's the way you have to hire a salesperson. They're not going to have that industry knowledge you have. They're not going to have the like understanding of your offering like you have. So you got to make them capable on day one of doing most of the work or having most of the work there for them. That was huge though. I mean, so when I brought in a salesperson, you know, he did the first probably 2 or 3 months of calls with me. And then I let him go and just had him run. And, you know, he closed over $1.5 million in sales in his first year. So it absolutely can work. It's just a matter of getting all the prep there and being disciplined again with taking the time to do that.
Yeah. Well, overall, I think the underscore is like documenting this and basically from day one, trying to remove yourself from the business. Otherwise, you're always going to like, you get into entrepreneurship, like build a business and do whatever. And then if you're like working in it 90 hours a week and just grinding, that's not
right.
That's not as fun sometimes.
Yeah. And you brought up that other point of the emotional attachment. You know, for some founders, certainly it is very hard to let go of those relationships with clients and not be the face that they know and speak to. And so getting over that and knowing that in the greater good of like trying to get, you know, build a bigger business, you're going to have to get out of those relationships with clients is really important. And just being okay with that and letting your team, you know, they're going to mess up a couple of those relationships, but like, you got to let them learn. Otherwise they're never going to grow into that.
So as we think about, again, getting started in a general sense, and maybe this is a good spot to kind of wrap up our conversation. What would you share with folks, whether it could be on the psychological side, again, maybe some coaching stuff, it could be on a tactical, like what would you share with them kind of with your expertise on how they should, I'm talking like the first step or the second step, things they should really consider early on, whether they want to start a business or maybe it's just pivoting from a full-time job to doing a side hustle, doing their own thing.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll tell you, like, I hate to give advice because I think generalizing, you know, what I've learned to everybody is probably not completely correct. So I'll caveat all my advice with that. And then I'll give you some advice.
Fair.
You know, here's what worked for me though, Brian, I'll do it from experience share standpoint, was once I got pushed out of the nest, my job got cut down to halftime. I had to go find a way to make some income and figure out what I'm going to do next. If I hadn't had that push, I don't know that I would have had the confidence to go out and build my own company and then buy a company and then be where I am today. Right. Like it all is kind of like it was a little bit lucky that that happened. So if I were to tell myself something, it would be push yourself out of the nest earlier, faster somehow. So for me, that would have looked like find a way to go be self-employed earlier in your career. And maybe I would have, been a couple years ahead of where I am now if I had just gone out and said, I'm going to get full-time self-employed, maybe been a consultant, been a started up this content writing business a couple years earlier. Who knows, right? But once I found myself full-time self-employed and was able to free up the bandwidth and the mental capacity and get rid of the distractions of having the day job, everything moved downhill, picked up steam quicker. The opportunities became more clear. The pathway became much more like exciting and visible, and like I could see it. So for me, that was the big unlock, was just getting into this full-time and figuring out how to make a living. And now, again, like the business on day zero was not perfect. It has a ton of things to improve and ways to change it. And now I'm out of most of it. But I wouldn't have known all that or gotten to that point if I hadn't been just pushed out of the nest.
No, I love that. Oh my gosh. I'm singing the praise on that advice. Well, there was a great, I'll kind of throw in as well, a great book I read. I had Mike Lewis on the podcast. His book's called When to Jump. I don't know if you've ever read it, but I think that's important for folks to maybe look at or read, because again, you might not be ready today, but if you give yourself, okay, I'm leaving in a year, or I'm leaving in 18, whatever it is, you now set up the parameters to make it a lot easier to, with the push. Yeah. You know?
I'd go a step further. I'd have that resignation email scheduled in my inbox for January 1st, 2025.
There you go. That's fair. Yeah. Everyone start wordsmithing on that email. Carl, it's a lot of fun, man. Where could folks say hello to you? Where do you spend the most time?
Yeah, my website is carllhughes.com, and it's Carl with a K. And all my socials that I'm active on, mostly LinkedIn and Twitter, are up at the top, but I'm Carl L. Hughes on both of those. I Twitter and LinkedIn are my most active, and I definitely respond to messages. Also happy to just, do email Carl, K-A-R-L, at draft.dev. Always happy to hear from entrepreneurs who are thinking about making the leap, just making the leap, or, just need some motivation, because the mental battle is the real. That's the thing to get over.
Yeah. Well, Carl, that's a lot of fun, man. Thank you so much for joining and sharing some insight today. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Brian. Good luck to you.
Hey, everyone. And just one more quick thing before you head off on your day. If you're enjoying this podcast and are looking for other resources and tools to help you get started and move forward toward a happier and more fulfilling life, then I'd encourage you to head over to my website, brianandreco.com, and hit the subscribe button in the upper right corner. There you can find my newsletter and blog subscriptions, where I share insights and information around getting unstuck, perspective, mindset, relationships, habits, and much more. If you get a chance to sign up, I hope you enjoy. Thanks again for listening in, and have a phenomenal day.